Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Taller, thinner, prettier, supermodel, or the new iPhone? And why a 7-year car loan may not be such a great deal. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Ting.com. Ting gives you big savings for mobile phone service. Try their online savings calculator and save $50 on your device purchase at marketplace.ting.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, September 12th. Thanks for joining us. It's faster, it's got a bigger screen, better camera, better color, and it's the lightest smartphone in the world. Do I really need to tell you what I'm talking about? The iPhone 5, what else? The official unveiling was today in San Francisco amid the usual Apple hoopla. Even the Foo Fighters showed up for this one. The phone goes on sale next week, and it's expected to be a blockbuster. But as Marketplace's Queen Akim reports, what Apple left out of the phone may also be key.
At the dawn of this tech boom, the promise was all about sharing and being friends. Back then, Google didn't have smartphones and tablets. And so Apple hosted Google Maps and YouTube on its iPhones and iPads. The vibe was all, mi casa es su casa. Roger Kay is an analyst at Endpoint Technologies.
Most people figured out when you share things, you don't make any money.
Kay says, now it's all about putting a big fence around your property and kicking all your friends out. Apple, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and Facebook
are trying to harvest profits within the walls of their garden.
For Apple, that garden is the iPhone and iPad. And once you buy one, Apple wants to be there to sell you everything. Sarah Rotman Epps is an analyst at Forrester.
In the new iPhone, we won't see Google Maps as the default map application. And that's because there is power in knowing where people are at all times.
In the not-too-distant future, Apple could make money by selling that data to, say, a 24-hour diner that can send you an ad when you leave a nightclub. Andreas Weigen directs a social data lab at Stanford. He says it's not just about selling you stuff, it's about collecting your data.
At the heart of trying to own the consumer is to own the identity of the user.
And the company that can really figure out that identity and direct you to the right 24-hour diner will emerge as the victor. I'm Queen Akim for Marketplace.
Germany's highest court today issued one of the most significant decisions in its history and a crucial one for the future of the Eurozone. It rejected a petition to block Germany's participation in the Eurozone Rescue Fund. So let's go to...
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
What's up, Europe? For more on the meaning of today's historic court ruling in Germany is Constanze Stelzenmüller. She's an analyst with the German Marshall Fund. Constanze, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So Germany's Supreme Court said, yes, it is constitutional for Germany to participate in this huge Eurozone bailout fund. What does that mean going forward for the Eurozone?
Well, the world has not come to an end. I'm being a little bit facetious here because one got the impression from not just Germany, but global media that that was what was going to happen if the court decided in any other way. What we have now is a situation that is essentially a compromise, but lets the government go forward, which is important for the euro crisis because Germany, as you know, is in the pole position as the major lender to the European Stability Mechanism.
Constanze, were there a lot of people in Germany who were actually hoping the court would rule the other way?
Well, I'd say there were at least 30,000, because that's the number and counting of people who signed up to this massive class action that the court was ruling on. Yeah. Just to make one thing clear, we haven't actually been paying money. We've just been promising to pay. But a lot of Germans, according to these surveys, appear to believe that we have actually been paying out a great deal of money to other countries who've been less responsible. That's not true.
You know, this has been such an up and down story. One week, it sounds like Greece is in the Eurozone. Next week, oh, they're about to be out. Now this big court case. Do Germans get bored with all of this, you know, Eurozone news, or are they paying close attention?
No, I think it's hard to get bored. for one, because it's about their own, the state of their own economy, the state of their own pocketbooks.
Right.
But the larger point here is that many Germans and many other Europeans are very aware that we are in a situation where we are really redefining Europe for a new age. And these days, I think the debate is about, well, if it's clear that we're not going to go to war against each other again, and if prosperity and growth isn't something that is automatically guaranteed that you actually have to work for, maybe there is another argument to be had and a redesign to be done to adapt the European Union to an age of globalization. The only way that we can have a voice in that debate is if we are united as Europeans and not if we let ourselves be divided.
Constanze Stelzenmüller is with the German Marshall Fund. Constanze, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
The German court ruling pushed stocks higher. We'll have details when we do the numbers. A new census report out today has the latest poverty figures. More than 46 million Americans were living in poverty in 2011, about the same as the year before, a surprise to many economists who'd expected the poverty rate to go up. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Shireen Marisol Meraji reports.
The Los Angeles Regional Food Bank is a madhouse. Forklift drivers zigzag in and out of the warehouse, balancing stacked pallets with cans of whole tomatoes and peaches. Michael Flood runs the place.
Our distribution last year was up 80% compared to the pre-recession days.
And he says there's no sign demand will go down. The poverty rate is holding steady at 15%, same as last year, according to the new census data.
It's about the only time that we as a nation focus on the poor.
Sheldon Danziger directs the National Poverty Center at the University of Michigan. He says it's important to focus on the poverty numbers because they show that even during a recovery, rising economic tides don't lift all boats. Danziger adds that
if deficit reduction frenzy leads to cutting the earned income tax credit, cutting back unemployment insurance, cutting back food stamps,
even more Americans could fall into poverty. Robert Rector from the Heritage Foundation agrees that we should focus on these statistics, but in a different way.
I do think we should be very much talking about the growth of the welfare state and the growth of the number of people dependent on welfare.
Rector believes poverty is a drag on the economy because, he says, the government spends $1 trillion on programs that benefit the poor, and nothing is changing. That debate is taking place back at the L.A. Regional Food Bank, too. Scott Wilderman is picking up food for his church's pantry. He says it's one thing for the church to help the poor, but
food stamps is socialism. We're not a socialist country.
Inside, LaRonda Sims, who has a full-time job there, says without government child care subsidies,
I will be in a shelter or something because I wouldn't be able to make rent or to make gas to come to work.
She says she's been poor and never wants to be there again. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
For retailers, it's never too early to think about Christmas. Neiman Marcus just leaked an item from its Christmas book catalog, a special edition Chrysler 300C with designer touches by a big name in American fashion, John Varvatos. Marketplace's Eve Tro has more on where the runway meets the road.
In the 70s, lots of fashion brands waved their magic style wands over cars. Matt Hardegree with Jalopnik.com has a few faves. The AMC Matador from Jackie O's favorite designer, Oleg Cassini. The Bill Blass Lincoln, complete with a Cartier clock in the dashboard.
And at the height of this craze, they even had a Levi's edition Gremlin. All the seats were denim.
Morningstar analyst Paul Swinand says Chrysler and John Varvatos, both from Detroit, make perfect sense for collaboration.
The question is how to do it in a way that both brands will actually be elevated.
Varvatos is known for taking street style to the runway. The hulking Chrysler 300 has major street cred. Varvatos' take on the 300 is a study in black, says Matt Hardegree at Jalopnik. Blacked out taillights, even the chrome Chrysler logo is black.
which fits with sort of its mafioso image.
Varvatos borrowed the look from the street, he says. A car that's bumper-to-bumper black isn't known as pimped out, it's murdered out. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
If you want to see some of those early special edition cars, we have photos at marketplace.org. Few of us can afford a special edition car, but your everyday edition? Well, that's been one of the few bright spots in this economy. Auto sales are up in part thanks to cheap credit and strong dealer incentives. Recent numbers show more consumers are taking out longer car loans, meaning they pay back the loan over a longer period of time, some up to 7 years. But as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains in this installment of our personal finance series, Money Matters, those long-term loans come at a cost.
Southern California gas station attendant Dallas Highfill earns $9 an hour. He's on the verge of taking out a 7-year loan for a new car.
I've always been a fan of the Mustang, and I finally decided that my current car is no longer suitable, so I want to get a Mustang.
In particular, Highfill wants this car. Salesman Ladie Sanchez at Galpin Ford showed me their latest muscle car.
The 2013 Mustang was redesigned for this year, so as you can see, it's got a new front end, new rear end on the vehicle.
And how much does this baby go for?
These particular cars start right around $24,000 to $25,000, and with options, can go up from there.
A $25,000 car is within reach for many consumers, thanks to strong dealer incentives, like 5-year loans with no interest. But people with low credit scores, like Highfill, often don't qualify.
Some people will not qualify for 0% at all, but, you know, it definitely is a hook that automakers and dealers use to get people into the dealership.
Jessica Caldwell is a senior analyst at Edmunds.com. She's been tracking a trend. Car buyers are taking loans that can be paid off over a longer period of time. The average loan for a new car has grown to 65 months, more than 5 years. Some loans go as long as 7 years. Those enable people to make a lower loan payment each month, but the trade-off is that the interest payments cost them more in the long run.
I think you're going to hit the point of 5 to 6 years thinking, gosh, why did I sign up for this loan? But in the short term, you know, you're getting a nicer car, probably something that you couldn't afford if you opted for a 3 to 5 year loan. And for a lot of people, it just makes sense.
Dallas Highfill knows the 7-year loan will cost more, but he thinks it's worth it to get his dream car.
It's that or get a 1993 Corolla or something, because I'm not going to be able to afford anything in cash for years.
According to his budget, a 7-year loan will leave him with enough money each month to pay for auto insurance. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up, debating the cost of life-saving drugs in India.
Half of my patients may not be getting adequate treatment. I'm seeing them dying every day.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street's mood was upbeat as the Fed kicked off its 2-day meeting on more possible stimulus moves. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 9 points, not quite a tenth of 1%. The closing number was 13,333. The Nasdaq also tacked on 9 points, a third of 1%, coming out to rest at 3114. The S&P 500 nudged up 3 points, almost a quarter of 1%, finishing at 1436. For all the hype over Apple's new iPhone, its stock didn't get the big bite you might expect. Shares of the world's most valuable company clicked up just a little more than 1%. Stock in Verizon Communications edged higher by a similar margin. It was a mixed day for the major European stock exchanges. Britain's FTSE stumbled a tenth of 1%, while the French CAC 40 rose by a similar margin. Germany's DAX advanced 0.5%. Bond prices slipped. The yield on 10-year treasuries rose to 1.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Ting, the new mobile service that makes sense, bringing billing, clarity, usability, and savings to mobile phone users. Ting bills megabytes, minutes, and text messages separately. If you use less than anticipated, the difference is credited at the end of the month. Ting has no premiums or penalties. You don't pay for more than you use. Save $50 on your device at marketplace.ting.com. That's marketplace.ting.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, D.C., a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department is scheduled to release its monthly statement for August. The Labor Department issues its producer price index for August. And a memorial service for astronaut Neil Armstrong is held at Washington National Cathedral. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdal. We all know the key role social media played in the push toward freedom in the Arab Spring. Today, some people are wondering about another effect of social media. There are concerns that an anti-Muslim video on YouTube helped whip up attacks on U.S. embassies in Cairo and Benghazi, Libya. We should note there are now reports suggesting the attack in Libya that killed four U.S. officials was planned and not the result of an angry mob. But the video does raise questions about YouTube, freedom of speech, and corporate ethics. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
YouTube is best known for Justin Bieber and cat videos, but now it's wrapped up in foreign policy. Jonathan Turley is a professor at the George Washington University Law School. He told his students today, YouTube didn't cause unrest in the Middle East.
People suggest that these murders were caused by a film. They weren't caused by a film. The anger was certainly caused by the film. But that's no excuse to engage in murder.
It also may not be YouTube's problem. YouTube built its business on being a forum for free speech. Yochai Benkler is a professor at Harvard Law School.
We have to be careful that the concern over the violence doesn't lead us to give up that anybody can communicate with anybody else from anywhere to anywhere.
They may be more like the phone company.
Jonathan Zittrain co-founded the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. He says YouTube is much more like a utility than a publishing company.
People don't turn around and say to Verizon, what are you doing providing telephone service to mobsters or unsavory people?
And what about the bottom line? You can find this same video on YouTube under a bunch of different names. Some of them have ads. But the way ads work on YouTube is that you can choose to sponsor a particular video or let an algorithm pick for you. Jeff Jarvis wrote, "What would Google do?"
It's not like the advertiser choosing to buy Seinfeld. They're buying ad availabilities on YouTube.
A YouTube spokesman says the video doesn't break the company's rules, so it'll stay up. But it has imposed restricted access in Egypt and Libya. Call it YouTube diplomacy. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
If you've been without a job for a long time, well, let me put it in perspective for you. The long-term jobless rate in this country is the worst since the Great Depression. In fact, the St. Louis Fed says about 7% of Americans have been unemployed for at least 6 months or have gotten so discouraged they've stopped looking for work altogether. But for those long-term unemployed who are lucky enough to find a job again, they may encounter a whole new kind of workplace than the one they left. From the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk, Chrissy Clark has more.
At this point, every one of us probably knows someone who's been out of work for a while. Right before the economy tanked, my sister-in-law, Ellen, took a break from her career in the financial services industry to raise her young kids. She planned to go back to work after a couple years, but the recession had other plans. She finally landed a new job this spring. On her first day, she realized how much can change in 6 years. For one,
the office is a lot quieter.
Not as many ringing phones or out loud conversations. Way more emails. And that fax machine is now a scanner. Little things you don't notice if they happen over time, but if you have to catch up all at once, overwhelming. Take that new version of Microsoft Office. Ellen's new coworkers have had time to get used to it. She has not.
And the toolbar was completely different. And that just about threw me over the top. You know, here I thought I knew how to use the technology. I sit down to work on the computer and I can't even figure out how to change my font.
Another change?
Everybody was younger.
And those fresh faces bring a whole new mindset to the office, according to Tom McBride. He's the author of The Mindset List that follows, among other things, the working habits of each new college class.
This is a generation that's grown up with the idea that they can check their data on their droid while at the same time jogging.
Or while sitting in a meeting, which can be a little disconcerting if you've been away from the conference room for a while. Of course, the changes aren't just at white-collar workplaces. Leonel Fuentes runs a job placement center near L.A. called Build Worksource. One of his clients had been job hunting for months after the machine shop where he worked shut down. He'd been the parts buyer for 20 years, and the main tool of his trade was the phone. He'd never used a computer. Now, prospective employers were asking him
if he knew how to purchase things on the internet, and he didn't know.
My sister-in-law Ellen says she can relate. her approach?
Take a deep breath, smile, and try to adjust.
I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
We've been hearing a lot from politicians about the best way to jumpstart the economy. Commentator Robert Rice says none of them have the right formula.
It's fewer than 8 weeks to Election Day, and neither party has put forward a truly convincing plan for reviving job growth. That's largely because neither of the standard remedies our parties cling to, Keynesian fiscal stimulus by the Democrats or supply-side tax cuts by the Republicans, will work. This isn't your normal recovery, because what we've experienced hasn't been your normal up-and-down swing of the business cycle. The fundamental structure of our economy has changed. For 30 years, median real wages have barely increased, and over the last decade they've dropped, even though the productive capacity of the economy has soared. And that disconnect between what the economy can produce at full employment and what people can spend without going into unsustainable debt is the core problem. Since the debt bubble burst in 2008, that problem can no longer be avoided or wished away. Keynesian pump priming assumes that at some point consumers will take over. Once the government has spent enough, consumer spending will then keep the economy going. But the middle class doesn't have enough money to take over where the government leaves off because its share of total income keeps shrinking. For their part, supply-siders assume business leaders and entrepreneurs will create more jobs if they're adequately rewarded with tax cuts. But they won't create more jobs without more customers. And as real wages continue to drop, most people can't and won't buy more. We're caught in a trap of our own making that defies the standard remedies. Neither Keynesian stimulus nor supply-side tax cuts, nor even the Fed keeping interest rates near zero, will restore buoyant job growth. The fact is that unless we get the economy back to the balance it achieved 30 years ago, when the middle class and those aspiring to join it received a much larger share of the economy's gains, we simply can't get back on track.
Robert Rice teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Beyond Outrage. Share your thoughts with us. Go to marketplace.org and click Contact. India's Supreme Court heard arguments this week in a long-running legal case about drug patents. Swiss drug maker Novartis is fighting for exclusive rights to produce its blockbuster cancer drug Gleevec. If it wins, it'll change the rules for generic drug makers who supply millions of poor patients in India and elsewhere. It's also sparked a wider debate about the affordability of life-saving drugs. Christopher Worth reports.
India is a growing market for advanced cancer drugs like Gleevec, but access to the best treatment divides between those who can pay for it and the people I met here. Amid the clamor of bicycles and taxis, hundreds of low-income cancer patients live on the sidewalk in front of India's premier cancer hospital, Tata Memorial, in Mumbai. And like Golo Barry Mahanto, who traveled from 1,000 miles away to begin chemotherapy, they can remain on the street outside for a long time as they receive treatment.
He has been here for 18 days and he has been told that he has to live here for 6 months.
And as Mahanto told my interpreter, he'd already spent $350 on medications, nearly a third of the average annual earnings for many Indians.
He says that the medicines cost a lot here. Besides that, I've come from a very small village. I have two kids at home, and I don't have enough money.
Most in India pay out of pocket for prescription drugs. That's thought to push millions of Indians into poverty each year. Inside the hospital, Dr. Pankaj Chaturvedi lays the blame on big Western drug companies that he says charge too much for the most advanced treatments.
Half of my patients may not be getting adequate treatment. I'm seeing them dying every day. It is such a frustrating experience. We would like the best drugs which are currently available, but those drugs may be beyond their purchasing power.
Novartis first developed Gleevec in the 1990s. It's modified the drug since then, which is why Ranjit Sahani, a company president, says it deserves a patent in India.
Gleevec is widely recognized as a medical breakthrough and has been granted a patent in more than 40 countries, including China, Russia, Taiwan.
And the U.S., where patented Gleevec can cost $70,000 for a year's supply. But India refused a patent in 2006 because it says the drug isn't really new. Under Indian law, pharmaceutical companies are prevented from continually renewing patents on existing drugs by making slight changes to original medications, a process known as evergreening.
Evergreening is basically you take an old drug and you apply for many more patents on it.
Lena Mangani is with the aid organization Doctors Without Borders. She says while advanced patented drugs are out of the reach of most Indians, India is actually home to a thriving generic drug industry that exports across the world. Generic versions of Gleevec in India cost 96% less than in the U.S. And Mangani argues a victory for Novartis would curb access to low-cost drugs globally.
If Novartis wins, the generic industry will possibly move back from producing some of the drugs that they do produce today. So this will have a chilling effect on generic competition.
And it's not just India where Novartis is coming under pressure. American health campaigners are urging the Obama administration to force the company to lower the price of Gleevec in the U.S. I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
That story came to us with the help of the International Reporting Project in Washington, D.C.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, just how many calories are in a Big Mac anyway? Well, starting Monday, it'll be easy to find out. McDonald's says it'll start posting calorie information in all its U.S. outlets next week. The chain's already doing it in cities like New York, where it's required. Now, I got a little curious about my personal indulgence, the double quarter pounder with cheese, and I found the calorie count on McDonald's website, 750 calories. Maybe I'll start downsizing to the double cheeseburger at 440. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the program for us. I'm Sarah Gardner. Hope you join us again tomorrow. This is APM.